Tom Turpin. Tom works for the Florida Citrus Disease or Florida Citrus Research and Development Foundation, and he's been working on a very innovative project to alleviate HLB or citrus greening.
Hi there. This project will be a little different maybe from some of the others because it's a case of trying to position something for high impact, but also it's very high risk research. So that many of you have heard about citrus greening disease. It's everything you would not want to work on. It's an unculturable, bacteriable pathogen. It's vectored into a permanent crop by a sap-sucking insect, infects the phloem, and kills the trees over time. You got no way to even know if you have a solution to this intervention without very long trials and very ambiguous endpoints. None of that is very attractive. So today I'm going to talk about half the technology side of what we sort of surveyed and why and how the program came together. It's just now in its final year and what we've accomplished. And then the other sort of half of the comments I'll try and commingle into this are what I think we've learned about how science can work best under these kind of circumstances and what we did right in that area and areas of emphasis. So it's kind of 3 points. If you're going to work on high-risk research, you need to articulate its impact. And if it's not, if you can't articulate the impact, you're probably not going to sell a high-research, a high-risk program. The second is on the significance of modeling. Science is kind of at its best when we can make predictions, and the predictions have a reasonable probability of being accurate. Other than that, science isn't all that great. What's the third thing? I should be able to remember three things, right? The most important of all, really, is adoption. Being able to diffuse and adopt what we all call outreach, but the same is true of research. We can't be sort of doing science in private and expect that the regulatory systems, consumers, and the public are going to be thrilled with that approach once we take it out of the box and explain it to them. Okay, so when this program came, I'll flip through a lot of slides really quickly and I'll just talk about what I want to talk about. The situation when we started was there was a National Academy study that gave us a really good list of priorities to work on, a good roadmap of what needed to be done, and we were well into that. We had implemented a lot of insect control strategies that slowed the spread of disease, and we had invested heavily in treating trees, protecting trees. The gaps that existed we knew about because we had organized national groups that met and talked about solutions to this problem. And those gaps were around the long-term genetic solutions. So a lot of this is buying time to get to genetic solutions. Those are the most sustainable. And when people say genetic solutions, they're usually talking about host resistance. But with what's happening in insect genetic technology, biotechnology today, there's also a possibility of enhancing what I will lump together as technologies related to biological control. Now, biological control we usually think of in insects is releasing parasitoids, and that's all great. But it's not effective. It's effective at suppressing populations. It's not enough to really move the needle for insect vector disease of a permanent crop. So we wanted to look at, and the gap that we identified was in this family of technologies that can result in population replacement of an insect population. So this is you take a population that has a phenotype like vectoring this bacteria, and you replace it with one that is unable to do that. So psyllids are not a big problem for citrus. It can be managed if it wasn't vectoring this lethal bacterial pathogen. And a lot of these technologies are also related to being able to do population suppression in insect populations. And the whole field has been stimulated really by investments from the Gates Foundation and others in mosquito control. So that's what we set out to do, to develop psyllid populations that were incapable of transmitting the disease, to provide management strategies and integrate this with outreach and grower practices. A lot of education component because it would be highly novel if it worked. So this was sort of a high-risk survey of several approaches, but the best way to understand it is to think about these gene drive mechanisms. So this is a case of non-Mendelian inheritance, and like most things in nature or that scientists come up with, it's already been done. So these systems exist. There's transposable elements, there's meiotic drive, there's homing endonucleases. These are all sort of selfish DNA systems that exist and can be adapted or engineered to carry a new phenotype into a population. So the way to think of it is sort of as a contagion or an infection that is either carried on a chromosome or carried in the cytoplasm or is itself an infectious virus. So we put together a team from across the country with expertise in each of these areas. And this is the point of how you sort of put together such a high-risk program, but potentially high-impact, when you don't have a lot to go on at the time. Like I said, this research program was set out to fill a giant knowledge gap. So we set up three teams with team leaders across chromosomal drivers looking for viruses in psyllid populations and in bacterial endosymbionts in the microbiome, particularly with Wolbachia in mind. That's a cytoplasmically inherited bacteria that skews its own inheritance in populations, so it acts as a gene drive system. And each of these are also what's necessary to characterize the fully characterized psyllid biology. And then we set up two teams that were looking for what we call effectors. So this would be the mechanism that is engineered or discovered to block the ability of psyllids to vector the bacteria. So it might be that for example, the bacterial pathogen can no longer infect the psyllid at all, or it can't get into the salivary gland, or any other mechanism. We use two approaches. One, and this is just basic biotechnology, one is a blind approach where you set up a screening system that is blind to anything but the phenotype, and you feed small molecules or whatever other discovery approach you're using into the system and just screen blindly for discovery of ligands. The other is the genomic approach where you take apart the components one at a time and understand how they all interact and fit together with the idea of interrupting some physical interaction between the bacteria and the host insect. And then we set up simultaneously a system to rear release and monitor the psyllid population, model the economics, and provide a public outreach system. So the idea here was that if any of these approaches were either dramatically successful or unsuccessful on the top half of the system, we would adapt and divert resources toward it with an active kind of management oversight approach. And we would have the diffusion team in place in order to implement it. And so, again, it's sort of, can imagine, it's not like any one of these is not likely to work, but because of the impact on this problem, we wanted to be in a position to take advantage of what we found. So these are the eight team leaders that were, again, I think, essential to running a good project. And I kind of very much appreciate their willingness to share their ideas and sort of pitch in on something this crazy. Bruce Hay at Caltech set out to assemble a chromosomal gene drive systems, and he has those in place. The major bottleneck in this case is we still cannot transform psyllids at the efficiency that we need to be able to do these sorts of manipulations. So this is a major bottleneck in being able to use these technologies in insects broadly, and I think that there needs to be a sort of a major national initiative just on being able to transform insects broadly. The viral system with Bryce Falk at UC Davis has turned out this has been a great discovery project that has led to other NEPA-funded program now. He has a number of viruses with full-length clones and is in the process of creating infectious transcripts from those. This will be quite useful to introduce genes into the psyllid as a biotechnology tool in general. And likewise, Kirsten Pelstilinski has surveyed and described the Wolbachia populations that are in psyllids already. So we didn't sort of pull the plug on any of the driver systems. Those are all still active. The one most likely to be used, in my opinion, is the chromosomal gene driver system. That's ready and good to go if we can just transform psyllids. Likewise, on the effector mechanisms, there were plenty of targets that have been identified by RNAi that can interrupt and give us the phenotype we're looking for. But we don't have a way to implement those into a psyllid population broadly. And likewise with the genomics approach. With Judy Brown's leadership now, there's sort of a very detailed parts list of how this bacteria circulates through its life cycle in the insect. Joe Pat at USDA Fort Pierce has led the effort to understand how to rear and release these. This is related to being able to rear psyllids as food for the parasitoids that are also being investigated for release and are being released as population suppression tools. And Neil Roberts led the UC Davis economic modeling, and Beth Grafton-Cardwell with the our social outreach program, which again, since we're not releasing psyllids, is more of an educational tool so that public is not surprised at the range of technologies that are under development. One thing we did find that we were in, I've already gone through the results as I talked about it. One thing we found that was unanticipated, but that we had the team and the tools to take advantage of, it was a discovery that when you feed these RNAi for particular targets, when you feed them to psyllids by introducing them into a citrus viral vector, so the citrus virus is carrying, CTV virus, is carrying the RNAi into the phloem of the citrus tree, and you feed psyllids, infected psyllids, on those trees, the phenotype you see is that for some RNAis we discovered, many of them are lethal, but the survivors had lost the Liberobacterium from the population. So the idea here was that if you had an area-wide planting at some size, this would protect or delay the ability of the bacteria to infect the entire grove. So we had invested significantly in modeling work that showed that was a reasonable prospect and what the size of the trials would need to look like in order to follow up on this phenomena. And basically the science was solid enough that there's a licensee for this technology, and the field trials are going forward, and someone's willing to invest in the regulatory pathway to bring that possibility to an approval, to a registration. So the rest of the time, how much time do I have left, by the way? I didn't look. How much time do I go to? 7 minutes? The rest of the time, I'm just going to talk a little bit about this sort of public component of it. The book, a few slides back, there's a book on gene drives that I referenced that was just published by the National Academies. And that book is really interesting. This book, I've been around this stuff a lot. I've built viruses, released them in the environment, done all kinds of stuff. And this book is 80% social science and about 20% science, like we recognize it. And the good news is, social science has changed a whole hell of a lot since in the last 30 years. And it's a real science. I mean, there's some really fascinating objective experiments done there. And the bottom of the line is if we're going to get science to be relevant in today's world, especially these new technologies, we have to completely change how we go about interacting with the public, with the regulatory agencies, with politicians. And there's a number of examples about this. A lot of these technologies are going to have to flow through the system as it exists now, and that includes the regulatory system that's outlined on this slide. And a phased testing pathway that is common to the release of other biological control agents, including sort of environmental risk assessments and the like. But you really have to ask the question, if we don't do this, is science really even contributing to solving a problem, or are we making it worse? If we bring out a solution and it is so sort of mismanaged with respect to outreach that the public rejects it out of hand, then we've done science and set backwards what we're trying to accomplish. So half of the issues on this slide up here, which I took from the Academy's book, is, you know, we don't talk a lot about public engagement, governance, and values, but we only talk about testing and risk assessments when it's on a regulatory pathway, and we're most comfortable just staying in the research corner. So there's three, I'm going to hit just three points that I took from this study that I think are most relevant to the kind of national program grants that we're talking about. Organizational challenges. It's one thing to go from sort of $1 million grant sizes and team sizes to $10 million. When you're managing programs at that size, you need, of course, great administrative and industry panel teams, but you also need systems to share data. You can't be in a position to share data with the public if you're not sharing it with your own team, and it needs to be happening in real time. So that's an area of, I think, really important effort. The second is changing how we think. There's this thing called the knowledge deficit model. And the idea is that if you've learned a lot, studied a lot, and know a lot, and you're an expert, you can approach others with the idea that their knowledge is just full of holes. And if you provide the information for those holes, then they'll think like you do. And it turns out that's not many, many studies show. And these are actual studies. You can make measurements on people's behavior and treat them just like any other research topic. It's not deterministic in the way the deficit model assumes. So this doesn't work, and we've proven it beyond a doubt. So what might work is better engagement. And I really like the words of this sentence here, because it's seeking and facilitating sharing and exchange of knowledge, perspectives, and preferences between or among groups who often have differences in expertise, power, and values. So unless we're kind of willing to open our minds to those discussions, we're never going to use really new, and all new technologies can appear threatening and foreign, and feel like they're coming from experts and those in power and those who may not share values with others. There's a whole lot of science in this area right now that you can look up. But engagement builds trust, and we have to realize that this idea of responsible science is something that we do with the public and we not to them. So that's my two bits on how to put together a high-risk, potentially high-impact program.
Okay, great. Questions? You stunned them. We have time. I thought there was some pretty thought-provoking. Oh, Sarah's got a question.
So she says, I'll paraphrase it, how do you do this and are you doing it? We've done it through the Citrus Foundation. So I'm a program manager at the Citrus Foundation, but I'm a project director for this grant. We've done it through regular meetings with the agencies that are information exchanges, so they know what is coming in the complete pipeline of solutions that we're engaged in. We've done it with growers through regular outreach sessions and polling, asking them questions about how do they feel about different solutions. And through the public, through internet outreach. Internet information is available. But I think that's the... None of this is necessarily optimally effective. I think that we need to do more and think harder about how to engage the public, especially in more early stage research. So our problem is you can't wait to the end to present them with the solution. They need occasionally. A handful of really good reporters that maybe work for the New York Times can write a story that is interesting enough that people will read it and disseminate it that way. I think we need stories. I think we need really well-written stories and more ideas on how to do that better.
Other questions? Okay, thank you, Tom.